Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by the Dairy Farm Families of Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board. Did you know that today Wisconsin produces more than 600 varieties, types, and styles of American, international style, and original cheese that win more awards than any other state or country? To learn more, visit eatwisconsincheese.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome to Cutting the Curd. We did some interviews a few weeks ago on location at Crown Finish Caves. On today's show, we have our interview with Dr. Paul Kinstedt and Slow Food Director Richard McCarthy.
Hello, this is Greg Blaze recording live from the Crown Finish Caves on Bergen Street in Brooklyn. I'm lucky enough to have Richard McCarthy, Executive Director of Slow Food USA here. Thank you for taking some time to chat with me.
No, thank you for asking me.
So for those of us who don't know what those out there who don't know what Slow Food is, could you tell us a little bit more about your organization?
Sure. We are the global community that hopes to inspire individuals and communities out there to change the world through food, and food that is good, that is clean, and that is fair. And this stands very much at odds with our, you know, kind of woefully Protestant self-loathing, food is fuel, the rush to scale and speed and efficiency that we are unfortunately pummeled with. And we want to connect with those who find both a desire for the joy and the justice in food. And so places like Crown Finish are sort of emblems of resistance to that sort of horrid rush to speed and scale.
Yeah, I'm a self-loathing Protestant. I need education.
You need help. Huh?
I need saving. That's fantastic. I think so many more folks today want food that's rooted in deeper values, quality, good for the earth, good for the producers, good for the animals. So how has Slow Food influenced these changes into how people, you know, think about their food? What progress have you made?
Well, you know, in many ways, I think we're winning.
How?
Well, there are...
I don't necessarily disagree with you, but some days I might.
No, there are some days where I feel like we will all perish before we get to the finish line. I think that the notion that food is a journey as we try and recalibrate our relationship with food politically, economically, culturally, is no longer this little boutique interest among the fringe.
Certainly.
Whether it is the proliferation of farmers markets and local food economies,
school lunch programs,
school gardens.
I think that's so important.
We're beginning to grow a generation who are not just consumers.
Right.
But they're protagonists for their own lives.
I agree with that. I think that there was a bubble of time where information, the dissemination of information and reality were not intersected. I think that despite the dangers of technology and the what we used to refer to as the global village, we shrunk the earth through a lot of devices, some of which I'm holding to talk to you right now, but those same devices have allowed anybody in any walk of life to click and learn about things like food. And I think that kids, I've found now, there's a generation of kids who are interested in what they eat, it's fantastic. I was fed terrible cheese when I was a kid. Some good, but terrible cheese. I didn't come from a place where food was held on high, but because I'm a country boy, it just got done for me, you know? And I had to discover my own path, but I like to give back. One of the things I like about slow food, both its Italian iteration and the Americans, is that you guys, you know, you give back willingly and ably to the people that you try to reach. Would you agree with that?
I would. I think that I think perhaps maybe the most important victory we can have is to sort of pull food off of that high pedestal of some sort of elite,
because it's looked
fanciful,
like
pleasure seeking thing that you only get if you have money.
Certainly.
And I think that what is beginning to take shape, because of the political realities, the sort of age of deconstruction, this age of it's not nihilism. Well, it is nihilism.
There's an existentialist crisis.
There's something going on.
People are struggling to find meaning in their world.
And you know what? You find meaning through food because you find community through food.
Certainly.
And I think it forces to the surface questions about the price of food, not only at the point of sale, but the societal price of food, the cost of food.
Well, we're running out of it.
The issues of scarcity.
Certainly.
Biodiversity. And as someone who has spent my life in social change work, which is generally, you know, usually on the losing side of all the issues.
The machine's pretty powerful.
Rooting for those who generally have few financial resources.
Mm.
There is something that is sustaining people through food, because they're gaining so much more than just the nutrients.
Sure.
But a sense of hope, a sense of community, and in particular, a generational invention of what the economy is going to look like.
Sure.
And the creativity that is in play, and the roots of democracy that are in play through, in particular, this localizing of our food systems and reaching out across boundaries that we have been told are insurmountable, urban and rural, between immigrants and native communities. I find a great deal of hope, actually.
That's why cheese is so wonderful, because it touches on all of those things and it crosses all those boundaries.
Yeah.
Cheese brings the country to the city really effectively, I think, more than any other piece of food that I've come across.
Mm-hmm.
It's built to travel, and it's built to... I think a lot of food is a lot of the way that we relate to food is memory, because it's so fleeting. It comes in, it goes out, you know. Within that process of gathering of it, no matter how simple that is to you, you know, there's comforting memory there. And I think that's why slow food and cheese work so well together, because they rely on time and they rely on community to create them.
You cannot rush them.
No, they happen when they do. Science and time. And so what's the relationship between Slow Food USA and cheese in the United States?
Well, I think cheese, more than maybe any other artisanal food or sector, is such a healthy marriage between traditional knowledge and scientific knowledge.
Yeah.
And I think it's in those kinds of unexpected relationships that we find the greatest excitement.
Slow food.
Yeah, slow food does.
Great.
And I think that tension is tension we should cultivate.
Encourage, yeah.
And encourage. I think the growth of fermentation in the U.S., again, who could have seen that 20 years ago, that we would be so fascinated with fermentation and realizing that the very things that we have run away from because of our fear of food and our obsession with everything being sealed for your protection, and instead recognizing that food should be living.
Sure.
And this requires knowledge and risk and investment in skills that we have otherwise said to do not matter anymore.
Sure.
So the raw milk and especially raw milk cheese phenomena is one that we have. I knew we played an important role early in the days of slow food coming to the U.S.
Sure.
And we are right now seeing a reorganization of the raw milk cheese presidium in the
yes.
U.S. And what's exciting about that is it's a thematic community. Mm-hmm. It's not geographic, because there are raw milk cheesemakers all over the country looking for fellowship,
yeah.
shared knowledge.
And people need each other.
Need each other, and we need to navigate what is a, sort of perilous regulatory environment.
Ridiculous, in fact.
Yeah, it is. And it's also coupled with an increasingly assertive and interested consumer base that is interested in solidarity and rooting behind these cheese revolutionaries.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Well, you know, we'll all continue to fight the battle together
yeah.
on our respective fronts, but it's good to know we're all on the same side. You know, thank you so much for your time today.
Yeah, and, well, thank you. Thank you for everything you do. Pirates unite.
Yeah, brother. Cheers. Ciao.
Ciao.
Today's program is brought to you by the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board. Wisconsin produces the world's best cheese, period. Why? Lush grasslands, glacial water supply, fourth-generation cheesemakers, combining old-world tradition with the new ideas and highest standards. The very best milk. What do you think of when you think of Wisconsin cheese? For me, I think cheese curds. Delicious, fresh cheese curds, or deep-fried cheese curds. Cheese curds literally any way, anytime, any place. I think about Andy Hatch and Upland's Cheese Company, the operation behind the Pleasant Ridge Reserve cheese that's literally America's most awarded cheese. I think of the deliciously stinky Limburger and its long-storied history. I think about Raleigh's Dumbarton Blue, a perfect blend of English-style cheddar and notes of blue. I think of Emmy Roth's Grand Cru Sirsois, which was named 2016's World Champion at the World Championship Cheese Contest. Wisconsin is like the world champion of cheese, and once you start reading the list of cheeses made in Wisconsin on their website, you can see why. The Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board is a nonprofit organization funded entirely by Wisconsin's dairy farm families. Read more at eatwisconsincheese.com, and as soon as you're done listening to this podcast, eat Wisconsin cheese. It's a no-brainer.
I'm here recording on location at Crown Finish Caves in Crown Heights, Brooklyn. I'm happy to have Dr. Paul Kinstedt here with me. Welcome back to the show, Doctor.
It's great to be here.
Yeah. It was such a pleasure having you on the show last time to talk about crystallography and climate change. Nowadays, you're in sabbatical working on updates to cheese and culture, correct?
That's correct. Actually, as of next week, my sabbatical is over.
Oh, you got to check all your emails now?
I got to check all my emails and not say I won't be back for another 6 months.
Well, we knew better. We kept bothering you anyway. What sort of new connections have you made or updates can you share regarding cheese, history, and crystallography since you were here?
Yeah, one of the areas that I'm working on intensely is the Jewish experience with cheese, Jewish history, and really understanding how the kosher laws and the Mishnah and the Talmud then influenced the Jewish people and their relationship with cheese in different places, in New England, in Northern Europe versus in the Mediterranean region. And you look at the cuisine, Jewish cuisine, and it varies in terms of how cheese is used pretty substantially. And so I've been trying to track back why is that so, and understanding how Jewish religious history particularly the laws of kashrut, the kosher laws.
That affects, as a cheesemonger, that's affected me in a certain way working here in New York City. Because people always are asking me for kosher cheese.
Sure.
And I'm telling them, no matter whether or not my cheese is kosher, as soon as I touch it or I cut it with the knives, my knives that haven't been blessed by a rabbi, it ceases to become kosher. And which I always found an interesting avenue to talk to people about their faith, because some people didn't care. They were like, nah, I'm just doing it for doing it. And other people were like, wow, that's very considerate of you, you know, and I could steer them to a place where kosher cheese was made. But what are you finding? What are you running into some crazy history there? I'm sure you are.
It's an enormously complex history, and as you'd expect with the Jewish community, like the Christian community, there's a wide range of sort of beliefs in terms of, you know, cultural Jews versus Reformed versus conservative versus Orthodox.
Right.
Ultra-Orthodox, and depending on who you're speaking with, you know, those concerns that you just raised about, or lack of concerns in some cases, will come into play. But that all has a history, you know, as to what the beliefs are and how the application of the Talmud and the kosher laws, you know, how finally they're applied. And it will make a huge difference in terms of the way Jewish folks react and enjoy cheese, and what, you know, what's kosher and what isn't, if you will. And I am not I am not from the Jewish community, so I am not an expert. I am trying to draw from the scholarship in this area as an outsider, and it's been very humbling and somewhat daunting.
But I'm sure you have a lot of good stories there. Maybe too many, in fact.
Too many. I'm not. You know, I'm contemplating possibly writing a separate book on that, because I don't know how I can stuff it in the second edition.
Yeah, there's
of cheese
a lot
and culture.
There.
It's huge. It intersects with some of the great, you know, issues of our time in
Certainly.
Terms of all sorts of cultural and social considerations that really everything has a history to it, and this particular history is very, very weighty.
Yeah, it is, for many, many, many reasons. I mean, it's into all culture. I grew up as a Protestant when I did, before I stopped going to church, you know, and I didn't realize, you know, that the version of the Bible that I was reading was, in large part, you know, a history of Jewish people.
Absolutely.
Back in the day.
And absolutely.
All of the oppression and all of the nasty shit that got done to them in this huge story that I was reading. I had no cultural reference point, because, you know, I was in a small community that was where there just weren't a lot of Jewish people.
Yeah, and you know, the lack of understanding because of the cultural, you know, strongly built into the culture, the practices and the kosher laws and the separateness.
Right.
And the lack of understanding that helped to create, you know, and mistrust, and it's a very painful history. I am a Protestant, and I'm a practicing, you know, it is my faith community.
My mom wishes I would go back to church.
And it's just, you know, Protestant, Catholic, Orthodox Christianity has had a hard time with the Jewish community. I hate to say that,
but it's the truth if you look at things realistically.
It's simply, and I want to bring healing between our faith communities and the Jewish community in some small way by using cheese as a lens to look at how the heck do we get to where we are.
And how
can we move forward, you know, in a loving way? And I know there's been wonderful efforts, you know, ecumenical efforts, you know, done by various segments of the Christian church, but I think there's still more work to do. I'm going to try and use cheese history as a way to, in a small way.
Cheese is the best item I've found in my life to act as a prism through which other people's lives are reflected.
You can reach people in ways that are non-threatening, that are engaging, and you have a commonality there.
Everybody loves the cheese.
Loves the cheese. You can't go wrong with cheese.
No,
you know,
it's true.
It's a great common denominator.
It's
the starting point for that. You know, in addition to the Jewish history, I'm working on you know, global climate change,
and
we talked about Mongolia,
which was still amazing to me. You know, and I still think about that discussion a lot, because it made me go back and listen to those podcasts, the hardcore history podcasts, the Wrath of the Khans, he called it, when Subadai and took the expeditionary force into northern and eastern Europe and just destroyed everything.
But I often.
As I was here a couple weeks ago, we were talking about epistemology and older cheese legends, whether they're beneficial or whether they're not. I started thinking of how nomadic cheese nomadic shepherds or nomadic cheesemakers back in those days, if they had left any droppings of knowledge along with all of the destruction that they caused.
Well, they left a genetic imprint, for one thing, and it's amazing with the biotechnology to track, you know, genetic lineages back. You can follow, you know, people groups and migrations and so forth.
Amazing.
So that all factors into reconstructing cheese history, because you need to understand people groups and their movements, and then you have other material records in the archaeological. Digs and so forth.
Sure.
And you put it all together and you start to get this picture, you know, this great sweep of history. People moving back and forth and
everywhere.
You know, from Mongolia into Eastern Europe and then back again, and this has been going on like for 10,000 years. As climate shifts and stresses are placed, people move.
Well, you go where the sun and the water is.
You go where you survive.
Yeah.
You know, and you adapt. And that's the story of cheesemakers right from the beginning. And the story of humanity, by the way.
Because I'm in my community and people, you know, we discuss this often, the importance of cheese, I find, you know, that outsiders or people who are, or they just eat cheese to enjoy it, they think I'm insane when I tell them that cheese is one of the most important, you know, documents
good for
of
you.
History.
Yeah, there you go.
I truly believe that.
Yeah.
As you scroll back through all of that, Hebrew history, what do you find to be their cheese of choice throughout the years? What's the cheese?
Well, it depends on where you're talking about. When you start in, you know, the antiquity.
Yeah.
When the nation of Israel existed. In Israel.
Yeah.
Writings, the rabbis knew very much about rennet coagulated cheeses of the time. They knew very much about acid heat coagulated cheese.
Sure.
They were you know, very much aware of sort of the portfolio of cheeses circulating in the greater Mediterranean area at the time. And, you know, the typical Israelite would, you know, these would be typically fresh cheeses.
Certainly, that's what I thought.
Very small.
It's acidified milk.
Yeah.
Buys you a couple weeks,
salted, eaten fresh. And you know, they didn't have a lot of animals. They didn't have a large volume of milk. They'd be made on small batches.
Sure, and they had to move.
And so, you know, they were pretty simple cheeses. But they were aware of, you know, for example, cheese is coming from, you know, the Black Sea region of
Certainly.
Turkey. You know,
and that's where it all
trade.
Starts.
Romans
then.
Loved those cheeses.
Yes, they did.
And they were aware.
And they
of,
still do.
And they still do.
Yeah,
I'm sure they do.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah.
And so, in the cheese community in the U.S., we have our academics that are sort of like celebrities for some cheese professionals. You're definitely on that list. Dr. Catherine Donnelly is on that list. She was recently on the show with Diane Stemple. Are there academics outside the U.S. who are producing excellent research on topics in cheese science that we should all look into?
Oh, gosh. In terms of cheese science, in Europe, there's wonderful resources. I mean, they do fantastic work. They have an enormous vested interest.
Yeah.
And typically governments support that type of research far more
than ours.
Generously than ours.
But
do you think that has to do with
the length of history, the European history versus the United States? Are we just adolescents and we'll get there? Do we eat our young wholly all the time in this country?
If you're talking about a place like Italy or France where you have this enormous legacy, history of cheese and a cultural imprint that is so deep that these cheeses mean more than just feeding the population.
Certainly.
They carry this cultural
significance,
heritage, identity with them, and so that enables the populations, the peoples, to be much more supportive of research and efforts to preserve these cheeses, you know, the traditional cheeses in particular, where we struggle in this country. I mean, there's been some wonderful work at the land-grant universities in America for 100 years and continues to be some great work. But we struggle to really muster the financial resources, the funding, to do the kind of, really fundamental work on traditional cheeses.
Certainly.
As opposed to the large scale production scenarios, you know, large factory type. I spent a lot of my life serving you know, my stakeholders in the big mozzarella cheese industry and cheddar cheese industry. So I know that. And,
yeah.
But to get the kind of funding to do for my Vermont cheesemakers, my 70 artisanal cheesemakers, it's a
We charge everyone a la carte prices here. That's how you order off the menu. You want healthcare.
Yeah.
It's no problem.
Yeah.
You choose a menu of options, and each of them are expensive. I think that's the way we do it with anything. But give me two names for Europeans that we can check out that'll help us out here as Americans to study cheese science further.
I hate to even name, but I mean, INRA, the you know, national basic, you know, in France, the basic institute, you know, for agricultural research in France, INRA does unbelievably great work on, you know, surface ripened cheeses, soft bloomy rind cheeses, smear ripened things. I'm going to talk about today.
Sure,
they do tremendous work, and there's some great people there. And if I just say one name, I'll get bombasted by the others. Why didn't you tell me my name? they wouldn't do that, but they might. Down in Italy, you know, the University of Milan and the great consortium, the Parmigiano Reggiano consortium, Grana Padano, and in Sicily, Corfalac, you know, do fantastic work, you know, on things like what is the role of pasture botanicals in you know, subtle flavors, you know, transferred from the flowers into the milk, into the cheese, and you know, really tracking that back. It's hard to get funding to do that kind of work in this country, but they understand this you know, imprint of the place on the cheese, and they want to understand the science behind it, and are willing to pay for it. So, you know, they're you know, in the Netherlands, there's fantastic resources there, academics in Germany, and all of the European countries have some, you know, I don't like to be jealous, but I have to admit there are times I have a little bit of envy at the funding level.
We like to do everything quickly here and profitably, and if it's not done in those two ways, we sort of brush it to the side.
We're results oriented, and you know, we gotta you know, assemble our beans and show them at the end of the day what we've done. And I understand that's important.
Yeah,
it's a balance
in a certain way. Well, I'm looking forward to hearing you speak, and we're going to record that as well, so people can look up and learn going forward.
Always a pleasure.
Thanks so much. Ciao.
Thank you for listening. Tune in next week for more special interviews.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.